ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is David Houle, a futurist, thinker, and keynote speaker who has delivered over 750 presentations and keynotes across six continents. David has also spent more than 20 years in media and entertainment, during which time he worked at NBC, CBS, and was part of the senior executive team that launched MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, and CNN Headline News. In addition, he co-authored This Spaceship Earth, a book that became the foundation for the global nonprofit of the same name, which aims to create crew consciousness as we face climate change. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, truly.
So first, I want to begin a bit with a definition. You're a futurist. Could you explain what that means?
The thing that made me a futurist was a talk I gave at Berkeley, and I was so profoundly in the moment that I witnessed it, and I said, what am I doing? And what I was doing at the time was being a catalyst to get people to think about the future and then to facilitate a conversation about it. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part of the answer relative to my value to the planet and to business is that I provide concepts and context to help people navigate the change that feels so unsettling to them.
Prior to this, you worked for over 20 years in media and entertainment, and you obviously had a transition then from a sort of more recognizable job that people are more able to get their arms around. Were you already practicing futurism while you were in those roles?
The way to answer that is, and it's how I kind of answer how I've become a futurist. All my life, literally, I've done things before people that people thought wouldn't work or that people thought were stupid or that later everybody did, right? Huh. When I graduated from college a long time ago, all I wanted to do was to live in a van. So I lived in a van, and people said, well, that's crazy. And then 2 years later, everybody was living in vans. And by then, I was backpacking around the world overland through Asia, and I had the amount of money that it took me to do that. Well, you could buy a house. Why would you want to go do that, right? And then, so the first time it intersected with business and media was thanks to my friend who you know, Jack Myers. I was introduced to the people who then hired me to join the team to launch MTV. And at the time, I was the number one CBS sales guy in Chicago selling time. And when I was asked by a guy named Larry Divney as to whether I wanted to join, I said to myself, this is in 1980, well, over the last 20 years since 1960, what are the two most dominant forces in popular culture? Television and rock and roll. How could this fail, right? But at the time, cable was only in 10% of households in the United States. There were only like 30 music videos in the world. Music video, what are you talking about? 24-hour cable network, what are you talking about? A channel just for kids makes no sense. And then in the 90s, with Jack Myers, we anticipated what is going on now. We put together a consortium of 10 network advertisers to fund network programming because that's the way it had been before the spot market came in the early 60s. And again, we were ahead of our time. I had all the creative people lined up. I mean, we had the rights for the CIA. We had the rights for the Actors Workshop. We had all the stuff, but the advertisers were too skittish. So, and then in the 90s, I also was managing director of a dot-com 1.0 to create online courses. Oh, that'll never happen. So it wasn't until this guy got to be at a ripe old age in his 50s that I realized, duh, that's my highest value. I'm consistently right about what's going to happen.
Right, being ahead of the curve. One of the things that you've said is that the information age is dead and that we're in the shift age?
Shift age, yeah. That's
shift age. Now, one of the things that is interesting is in media and entertainment these days, everybody's talking about data, data, data. And that's, you know, not only in, well, I guess media and entertainment is sort of spread like an octopus into other fields, you know, in that Facebook is media and entertainment. Brands are starting to develop content. So data is really informing so much. Now, how does that square with the information age is dead? And is that just I'm playing semantics, or is there something that people are missing?
You have two valid things I want to comment on. One is data, but first the shift age. I grew up in Toffler. He's the greatest futurist of the last 100 years. And he introduced me as a young man to the concept of ages, right? So from the vantage point, I looked back, from the vantage point of 2005, I looked back to when the information age got its name, which was in the 70s. And I realized from the vantage point of 2005, five things had happened in those 30 years, and the sixth one was happening, and that those six things would force us to be in a new age. The five things that had happened from, say, 75 to 2005 was the end of the Cold War, the beginning of the global economy, personal computing, analog to digital, and the internet. And then what was happening in 2005, I could see we're blowing up, was high-speed wireless. So I knew we had to enter a new age. And when I wrote the book, The Shift Age. That's what I'm known for. We've left the information age, entered the shift age. And the concept of the shift age is that it's loosely time congruent with the first quarter or third of this century. And it is truly a shift from reality as we've known it up to 2000 to reality as we'll start knowing it in the mid to late 2030s. So that's the shift age.
So when you say reality, what do you mean? I mean, reality, are you talking about this sort of screen reality versus physical reality?
That's, or is it another? Well, I'm talking about the fact that whatever you think is real, you know, is going to be profoundly changed. Go to the highest level. The definition of life might be changed. The definition of people may be changed. So that's at the highest level. But relative to the two realities, I coined that back, you know, in 2007, that we now have two realities, you know, particularly with the iPhone first came out, right? I said, we now, everybody who is listening to my voice now, is living with two realities, the screen reality based on digits, and the physical reality based on atoms, because we have these smartphones. And because digits morph much more quickly than atoms, the change first appear on the screen. So, for example, why will big box stores and physical retail and shopping centers collapse in America in the physical reality? Because of something over in the screen reality called Amazon.com. And then, you know, of course, Uber, and of course, Airbnb. So the screen reality, you know, so people are listening to me speak, and they're also maybe checking their phones to see what happens to their reality outside their physical reality. So we've got a bifurcated reality. And, you know, that's one of the ways you map generations, right? The silent generation is not very screen reality oriented. The baby boomers have come to it. The Gen X, certainly. Millennials and digital natives are all primarily screen oriented.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that the screen reality is disrupting the physical reality? That sounds like...
Of course, yes.
So it's the ascendance of that screen reality.
Yeah.
So going back, though, about data, I do want to touch on that, because one of the things you've talked about is the importance of art. And increasingly in media companies, there's a reliance on data. And I wonder if art and the gut and the humanity is being undervalued. And I'm curious as to your take on that.
The concept about data is the way I describe it, at the biggest level, it's the third stage of human mapping. The first stage was just figuring out what the planet, you know, the continents looked like. The second stage of mapping was how to map and transverse the continents and the oceans. What big data is real-time anthropology and sociology. It's the mapping of human behavior real-time. That's the highest value for certainly media and advertising. We live in a sea of data. We create data. Here is a data point about data. In the year 2004, humanity created as much data as has been as was created from the dawn of man through 2003. And depending on the source that you look at, that amount of data, dawn of humanity to 2003, is getting replicated every 4 to 8 weeks now.
Wow.
So, you know, I have a chart that I show. A zettabyte is a billion terabytes.
Wow.
I did this forecast in 2012, so I think it's conservative. But in 2010, humanity created 1.8 zettabytes, that's Z-E-T-T-A, zettabytes of data. 1.8 zettabytes of data in 2010. And in 2040, we'll be creating 12,000 in the year. So it is all data driven. In other words, the executive suites anywhere are not going to be having conversations, well, what do you think? Or what's your opinion? It's going to be, well, let's look at the data.
Well, I would say that that's what's going on now. Where does art and humanity fit in, and how critical are they?
They're absolutely critical. They're the most critical form of thinking and doing in the data age. I'll give you an example. So I'm the futurist in residence at the Ringling College of Art and Design in Sarasota, Florida. And it's one of the top art and design schools in the world. You know, Hollywood Reporter ranks it 15th in film. It's number one or two in computer animation. And a few years ago, the intelligence community, the people outside Washington, CIA, and stuff, started hiring our graduates. And my first moment, I had to pause on that. And then I realized, they get so much data. They need artists and computer animators to interpret the data, right? Because raw data does nothing. It's how it is graphically displayed to those that need to make decisions from it, right? Here, this is increasing, this is decreasing. I was fortunate enough to give a speech at NASA, at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. And when I went into the building of Earth Sciences, they have all these great displays. I'm sure you've seen if you've gone to the NASA website. And they said, yeah, we have 20 computer animators in our building, right? So art is needed to provide translation to data.
Okay, so it's the interface then. It's
the interface. But on a higher level, and again, this is a big, simple concept, the 20th century was the left brain century, right? It was the century of science, engineering, discovery, computers. And I feel that a large part of the 21st century is to go back and infuse all that scientific left brain with right brain humanity. You may come to Ringling thinking that you are going to be a computer animator, and you may well be that, but by spending 4 years in learning creative thinking and design-driven thinking, you might end up being upper management of a regular corporation, because it is that type of thinking that's going to be needed in a world where everything is changing, reality is changing, and data needs to be humanized.
Right. So what is it about the creative thought? If I'm an employer and I'm looking to hire somebody, I want this person on my team because they'll be able to understand the data, or they'll be able to interpret it for me, or what is it? What is that secret sauce that they have?
Well, intuition plays a big part in decision making. And what do CEOs say? We need some out-of-the-box thinking. We need some new paradigm thinking. I mean, so that's business speak for creativity, right? And that ties in with legacy thinking too. But the point is, if you want to be outside the box, you know, the left brain thinks in boxes, the right brain thinks in circles, if you will, I don't know. But out-of-the-box thinking, new paradigm thinking is creative thought. I wrote a book, my seventh book, called Spaceship Earth, about climate change. And the solution to climate change is all design. I mean, we are in the golden age of design in history. And that relates to the TED talk I did on technology, right? Everything we have ahead of us has design as an integral part of it. I can't think of anything that's not about design to some degree. You know, like for climate change. We have to redesign the energy structure. We have to redesign transportation. We have to redesign and design cities. We have to redesign our agriculture. So in the data world, data is just data. So how can we shape it into understandable human contexts? And I think artists do a better job of immediately transporting one to a different state than, say, an engineer would, right? So you can make $500,000 a year right now if you're a data scientist. You can make $1 million a year now if you got a PhD in artificial intelligence. But that's building the stuff. As it migrates out into the greater economic landscape, all this new possibility has to be interpreted to some degree intuitively.
Well, and I guess that ties in with legacy thinking. Can you explain mm-hmm. what legacy thinking is?
Back on January 1st, 2010, I called 2010 to 2020 the transformation decade. In the dictionary definition, a transformation is a change in nature, shape, character, and form. And therefore, I said that this would be the decade of the collapse of legacy thinking. And the basic way to simplify it is that particularly if you're over the age of 40, you've spent the majority of your life in the 20th century. So that's when your thought was formed. So you develop thinking. So it's kind of like the world moved into the 21st century holding 20th century thought. And so the legacy thinking is, you know, my dad always said, or my business mentor told me in 1993 to always do that. And so that's what you do. But if you haven't opened that up and analyzed it relative to the reality in 2018, you might be missing something because you're holding on to legacy thinking. That's why I think there's such disruption in the advertising and media business, right? Because if you're in a business, if you're an over-the-air broadcast network, you were threatened by cable, but you still thought you're great. And if you're cable, you're threatened by the internet. So it's these waves of thinking of, you know, that are represented in business models that get superseded by new business models. So this is really the decade. One of the things I say relative to legacy thinking is that this decade, 2010 to 2020, is the first decade of 21st century thought. So what does 21st century media look like should be the biggest question the media industry should answer. What does 21st century advertising look like? Not like how do we adapt kind of what we know and used to work into this new model that we're not sure whether it will work, right? The historical model is that all of the last century's stories, the 20th century stories, started 1914, 1918, you know, first industrialized war, Russian Revolution, general theory of relativity, the map of Europe, and very unfortunately, the map of the Middle East as the English and the French arbitrarily defined it, right, with these straight lines and right angles. I think future historians are going to look back and go, this is the decade where humanity really started to face this new century. That's my mission in life, is to get people to face it.
Well, I'm curious, is the suggestion then, you mentioned, you know, it's not so much about adapting, you know, and pushing the legacy thinking to this new environment, but almost blowing it up and forming yes. something new. So one of the things, there are whole practices around, you know, change management. And it's change management very frequently involves adapting to change, but it almost seems like that goes so slowly that by the time you've adapted, you're already behind. So how do you manage change when change is accelerating? How do you, as a leader, blow everything up without blowing everything up?
Well, two statements, and then we can dig deeper. You know, there's the classic statement, leaders create change and managers manage change. So it's the leader's job to create change. You know, I had the good fortune of working with, you know, Bob Pittman and Tom Freston and John Lack to change the music industry with MTV. And I had the great luxury of making lots of sales calls with Ted Turner. Ted Turner was all about creating change, right? So that's what leaders do, and then managers manage change. And what I say to people, I mean, this is almost a metaphysical concept, well, it is, is the only way to not feel change is to always be in a state of change, because the only constant in the universe is change. So if you are unsettled by change, or if you are resisting change, it means you're in a fixed position, and that fixed position is keeping you from seeing the present and the future clearly.
Right. If your leader is creating the change, is telling you how to blow everything up, vision the future, how do you migrate without damaging your existing business? How do you adapt to this future
you have to take the point of view that the change might damage the existing business. I mean, there's no other way to answer that. Right.
I see. So it's a bit of a leap of faith. Like when you were making the leap into MTV and music meets TV, it was a gamble.
It was a total gamble. I mean, on a personal level, I'd worked at NBC. I was hired away by CBS. ABC was always trying to hire me. I knew I could go back and make a great living selling time.
Ted Turner. You had a backup plan.
I had a backup plan. And you know, the backup plan. So let me back into this with the context. I say today, please don't use the word innovation. Innovation is the 90s word. You know, innovation is nothing but iterative change in a time of transformation and disruption, right? I mean, the example I always use is if Steve Jobs was an innovator, we would have gotten a BlackBerry with a bigger screen. Instead, he was a disruptor and we got a touch screen, right? So, you know, why is Netflix number one in the world? Because they did the obvious. I mean, I said 10 years ago that streaming would disrupt television. I mean, that was totally obvious. But why was it obvious? Because I wasn't invested in a business model that didn't involve streaming. So you look at what's happening with Hulu, and you look at what CBS and Viacom want to do, and Disney wants to do with streaming, and it's kind of like, oh, we better get on this, right? But they couldn't see it because it was antithetical. It was non-existent model for them. And that's why they're playing catch up.
Well, and it wasn't even non-existent to them. It was actually threatening to them. And so there was a stake in not seeing it in one sense.
Think about what you just said, right? The establishment is always threatened by what's new. And the establishment always loses unless it adapts to what's new, right? So. Right. You know, one of the things I see in corporations, if corporations are of a significant size, I suggest they do this: hire somebody who knows the business, who is to be positioned outside your business, and to look at the rest of the world and all the trends. This is why companies bring me in, right? You know, what's going on out there that might disrupt either our product line, our business model, or our business processes. And companies that, once you think you're together, you become undone, right? When you think you've got it going for you is the most dangerous time, because you stop looking at what might compete with you. So that's what happened back in the day with MTV and CNN. We couldn't sell because there wasn't anybody in the buyer side called cable buyers. They're just network buyers and spot buyers.
Right.
And so we were diminished until we succeeded, right? And the fall off in network viewing, which was Ted Turner's original calling card, particularly in C&D markets, you know, he had to come in the back way. And all of a sudden he was there. And the interesting thing about media is the smart people in media always migrate in time to the new media. Like the best and the brightest of broadcasting were in cable early. And the best and the brightest of cable went into the internet. The visionaries always move to the next big thing.
Right. Well, and what's interesting there, and this is, we're quickly chewing through our time, but I have one more topic I want to touch on, is whether or not new technology has a moral value one way or the other. I mean, people often are upset. They think, you know, AI is going to take over jobs or what have you, and this is morally bad, or the internet is disrupting all these jobs in traditional cable and broadcast. So how do you feel about the morality of technology and change.
Okay, that's a great, if it's the last question.
It's fine. The last question.
I have two answers to it, and hopefully I can fit it into the time. First of all, technology, with the exception of things created purely to kill people in times of war, other than that, technology is morally neutral. It's how people use it. The Wright brothers invented flying, which shortens distances, but 16 years later, humans were using it to drop bombs. So that's one thing. Relative to AI, the highest way I think everybody has to start to look at it so they'll understand it is, universally, whenever you hear a presentation about the top 25 inventions of all time, electricity is always number one, because a lot of the other things needed electricity, right? So, and if you think about what electricity did, more than any other invention, it transformed how humans live on the planet, right? It allowed us to air condition the Sun Belt. It allowed us to create electronic media. It allowed us to create a kitchen where it wasn't just the stove, but the microwave, the toaster, and the coffee maker, right? But at the moment that we first saw electricity, all of it was a flickering light bulb. So the only business that might have felt threatened were the candle makers. But when we first saw electricity in that flickering light bulb, we couldn't see the refrigeration of the desert, right? It all had to come after it. So 2.5 years ago, I really got frustrated by how stupid the conversation around, quote, artificial intelligence was. You know, robotic overlords, losing jobs, this and that. In other words, present reality being threatened by something. And this is the key point. We shouldn't deal with it from a human point of view, but a larger intelligent point of view. That's my message, is this is, you know, I say to millennials, I say, your grandchildren are going to look back and go, Grandma, Grandpa, you were alive in the 2020s and 2030s. What was that like when it all changed? There's more change in the next 20 years than the last 50. My job is to make sure that whoever listens to this podcast thinks differently about the future in some way.
I'm sure they will. So they can find you at sarasotainstitute.global. Is that right?
Yeah, it's David Hool, rhymes with cool, and sarasotainstitute.global. Those are, and you know, all my books, you just type in David Hool books.
Thank you so much. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, David Hool. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.